This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
The huge success in cinemas at the moment of the movie Bohemian Rhapsody about the life of Freddie Mercury has revived interest in the career and the music of the rock group Queen. A couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of speaking to Peter Freestone, who, for the last 12 years of Freddie Mercury's life, from 1979 to 1991, was the Queen lead singer's personal assistant. The interview is in two parts. We talk about Queen during the glory years of the 70s and 80s, including that performance at Live Aid in 1985, but then I also spoke to him about the death of Freddie Mercury. But I began our conversation by asking him when he met Freddie Mercury.
I actually met him in October 1979. I was actually working at the Royal Opera House in London, the Royal Ballet, looking after stage costumes. Freddie was a special guest star at a big charity show that the Royal Ballet put on. It was the first public performance of Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Wow. He had a backing track and he sang live. And he was wearing sort of the leather hat, the glasses, leather jacket, jeans and things. Mm-hmm. And he was being sort of manipulated around the stage by a dozen, 18 dancers from the Royal Ballet. I mean, I hesitate to say he sort of danced with them because he didn't. I mean, he was concentrating on the singer and let them move him around. At the end of Crazy, he disappeared behind a wall of dancers, and they then sort of 20 seconds later hoisted him up, and he was wearing a silver sequin outfit and proceeded to sing Bohemian Rhapsody. It was an amazing performance, and I told him that afterwards when I did actually meet him. And he says, thank you. And then he said, but I've seen you at the Opera House, you know, when I've been there for rehearsals. What do you do there? So I said, I look after the stage costumes, put them on the dancers, and off they go. And he says, oh, okay. And that was the end of the conversation, maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes. But then 3 weeks later, someone from Queen Management rang up my boss to ask if I would be available to do a six-week tour with Queen looking after the stage costumes. So those 3 or 4 minutes worked.
Should have been a night at the ballet rather than a night at the opera, their album title.
I thought it was going to be a much easier life looking after four people
than it was going
to be looking after costumes for a ballet company. Yeah. But it wasn't. Each of them had their own thoughts. Each of them had their own demands. You know, it was.
Was Freddie as flamboyant off stage then as he was on stage? He was the greatest showman in rock history and probably the greatest frontman in rock history. What about off stage?
He was a quiet, somewhat insecure, shy man. If there was a room with 10 people he did not know, he could not enter it on his own. If he went in with a friend of his, who then introduced him to the 10 people, he would be fine. Everything would work fine. He was very, very shy. He was painfully shy. He could not introduce himself to people unless he had friends around him.
So was that part of your job then, is to kind of shepherd him around and look after him?
Yeah, my job was to make his life livable, you know, to do the things for him that the normal mundane day-to-day life, you know, answer the telephone, answer the door, do some shopping, do some cooking, you know, all of that sort of thing I did.
Yeah.
So that he could concentrate on the hard things like writing music or making music, okay, performing. Yeah, I mean, even if we went out, there would be a group of us, you know, 4, 5, 6 people. But Freddie could not go and introduce himself to anybody. We would have to bring people in to be part of the group, and he would start talking with them.
So he was more at home in front of 100,000 people than 10 people?
Yeah, because with 100,000 people, you're not talking to any specific one person. Although, saying that, when Freddie performed, you know how so many artists will find a spot and perform to that spot in the back of the hall somewhere. But with Freddie, he tried almost to make a point of trying to get eye contact with just about everybody so that each person could feel that he was performing just for them.
We're talking about Freddie Mercury, and we are talking about the great Queen frontman with his personal assistant for the last 12 years of his life, Peter Freestone. Peter, tell me then, you were doing those things at home for him. Did you feel that you were becoming a friend, though, closer than just an employee?
Oh, yeah, very much so, very much. And Freddie wanted it that way. Right from the very beginning, we got on very, very well. For the first 6 weeks, I was employed by Queen to look after the stage costumes. That carried on for the American tour. During the European tour after that, Freddie decided he was going to be away from Britain for 2 years, so he wanted someone with him, and he asked me if I would do the job, you know, just to be with him everywhere else, anywhere around the world.
That's an incredible offer.
But the thing is, we just got on so well.
Yeah. But what did you have to give up then to do that? I mean, what kind of a life were you leading prior to that?
Before that, it was just like all of us, you know. Yeah. I had my job, I had friends, went out. I mean, the thing is, I've never really in my life had a Monday to Friday 9-to-5 job. And with Freddie, you didn't sort of go out at a weekend, you went out every night. I gave up my life, basically, to live his life.
Now, I believe he was a very keen stamp collector as well. I mean, most people seeing him on stage would never associate Freddie Mercury with being a stamp collector, but is that right?
Well, the thing is, that was earlier on rather than later.
You didn't have to rush down to the post office, you know, to get those first day covers for Freddie?
No, well, in fact, in the last few years, yes, I did. Because he would send them to his nephew, who Freddie had decided was going to be collecting stamps.
How do you think Freddie would feel then, knowing that he would end up on a stamp one day?
I don't think he would never even have dreamt of something like that. He knew he was a good musician. He knew he had written some wonderful music, but he never put himself on the same pedestal that he put people like John Lennon or Elvis Presley. He never dreamt of himself in that sort of style. For him, he had a talent and he used it, but he never sort of considered himself one of the most amazing musicians around.
Even though everyone else felt that way about him.
Yeah, he very, very much had his feet on the ground.
Freddie Mercury is the man we're talking about. Peter Freestone was his personal assistant for 12 years. Can we go back to one of the most extraordinary days in the career of Queen? And that's Live Aid. What are your memories of that day?
That was when it dawned on Freddie exactly how much power he did have. Normally in Queen shows, they were always in the dark. So you saw a little bit of what was in front of you. That night, or that evening, because it was still daylight at 6:40, Freddie saw 80,000 pairs of arms clapping for Radio Gaga. And it actually dawned on him exactly how much influence the band had. And it really made Freddie very, very much more aware and much more careful of what he said, because he never wanted people to live by what he said. People have their own lives. He hated when anybody who had influence used it for political purposes, for religious purposes, anything like that. Those are things where people have to make up their own mind. He had the whole world in the palm of his hand on that day. Mm-hmm. And it really, in some ways, it frightened him.
Was that his favourite day?
I think he would say that it really was. It might not have been his best performance of all the shows that he'd ever done, but he was very, very proud of that moment. And the thing is, basically, it was just because Queen actually bothered rehearsing. You know, for those 20 minutes, they spent 4 days rehearsing. Mm. And even to this day, whenever there's any of these big charity shows like this, nobody bothers rehearsing. They just think, oh, well, we know our songs. We'll go on and play them, and that's it. We don't have to worry anymore.
Where did you watch that Live Aid performance?
I was backstage watching from, as you look at the stage on the left-hand side where the band came on from, mm-hmm. I was on the back there.
So what happened when they came off stage after that performance?
I mean, they were like floating. They were walking on air because they accepted it wasn't going to be like a Queen show where everything runs like clockwork and with military precision. But they were just so ecstatic over the audience reaction. And also because from then on, everybody would come and congratulate them on the performance they'd given. Mm. And to be congratulated by your peers is, I mean, it's not quite the same as 80,000 people in an audience. But, you know, people that they respected were coming to them and saying, what a wonderful job. So it gave them that little boost. It gave them that little bit extra.
Peter Freestone was Freddie Mercury's personal assistant during that whole time, before Live Aid and after it as well. Along the way, you must have met a lot of other huge stars. I know you met Michael Jackson. In fact, a lot of people may not know that Freddie and Michael collaborated. Tell me, what was that like?
That was amazing, actually. And also on that point, the three tracks that Freddie and Michael worked on the day that they were actually together, it was wonderful. I played video games with Michael Jackson on that day. He was really sweet and naive, I think was the best description. I mean, he had the most amazing talent. I mean, that Freddie and he actually worked very well together. I mean, they got on very well together. The reason nothing happened afterwards was purely because timing. There was never a time when both of them were free to start work, you know, to carry on working together.
Of course.
I remember on the tour of the house, he took Freddie and me on a tour of his house, and there were all these multiple platinum disc awards for Thriller. Just lying here, there and everywhere because he hadn't got space to put them up. And so they were just leaning against the wall or on the floor or, you know, it showed that, okay, like for any artist to be, you know, to have the biggest selling album of all time, you have to be, it has to strike you. But the award side of it just was not so important for him. And Freddie loved that because Freddie used his awards as wallpaper. They weren't put up for people to admire. They were there to sort of fill up gaps in the wall.
Queen has had a life since the death of Freddie Mercury, either with the stage show that Ben Elton helped to write, along with the music.
We Will Rock You, yes.
We Will Rock You, a huge success. What about the fact that some people have tried to take the place, as it were, of Freddie out the front of Queen, whether it be Paul Rodgers or George Michael?
What I would say, nobody has ever, none of them have ever tried to replace Freddie. No, Queen, the band, Roger, Brian, John, they would never countenance someone replacing Freddie. They will sing with another singer, but it would never be, they never could replace Freddie.
Of course
they
not.
Know that.
Yeah, of course
and
they
everybody.
Do. Yeah. But why do they continue? I know they want to keep making music and they want to play Queen music, but why do you think they go on with this?
They're musicians. That's what musicians do.
They can't go on and make their own music?
Well, the thing is, they did do a new album with Paul Rodgers singing. Again, also, it's harder because, you know, the fans expect so much. The fans want so many different things. You know, what are they able to give that's going to make everybody happy? It must be very, very hard for them. Very hard indeed.
Peter Freestone talking about the career of Queen and Freddie Mercury. But of course, it ended tragically in 1991 when Freddie Mercury died of an AIDS-related illness. I also spoke to Peter Freestone about that, and he told me about how Freddie Mercury told him that there was something wrong.
I suspected from the time he had a biopsy done on a mark on his wrist. And it remained suspicion for about 2 months, 2-3 months. And then I was in the kitchen one day in Garden Lodge, and the internal phone rang, and it was Freddie asking if I was alone in the kitchen. And I said yes, and he'd manipulated it because he'd had Terry go and get him something from a shop somewhere, and he knew Jim was outside somewhere and that Joe was at the gym. So he came down the stairs. He said, look, I've got something I need to tell you. I says, okay. And he says, look, you probably know that I'm not 100% well, that I'm sick. I said, well, I don't know, but I've got an idea. And he says, and you probably know what it is, don't you? And again, I said, I don't know, but again, I've got an idea. He said, look, I have AIDS. I don't know how long I've got. All I know is that we will never speak about this again, and I have a life to live. I never want any pity. I never want anybody to make allowances for me. I just want to carry on and make the music. And the thing is, music was Freddie Mercury's life right from the very beginning when he said, I don't want to be a star, I will be a legend. And that was his reason for existing, was to create music. And from the time that he told me that, he actually then did do the Barcelona album, The Miracle, Innuendo, and the tracks that he left behind for the band to work on when he died. None of us knew when we were told how long he had. He didn't know. The doctors didn't know. Nobody knew. It just sort of concentrated his mind to make sure that he could do as much as possible before the disease wouldn't let him.
This was a very different time. These days, high-profile people have diseases or conditions and they make a big deal about it. They want other people to know about it. That didn't happen in those days.
No, there was such a big stigma,
yeah,
particularly with AIDS in those days. And he just wanted to protect his family and the people around him because everybody would be tarred with the same brush.
Was he bitter about it? Did he hold grudges? Did he want to know how he contracted it?
No. He was never one to waste time on things that he couldn't control. Some of the best advice he ever gave me was never say to yourself, what if, or if only. Because you're thinking about things that you cannot change. You live for today, you live for tomorrow. You do not waste time thinking about what has happened in the past. He got on with his life. I mean, we were told by the doctors in October 1989, you know, just to be prepared that Freddie might not see out Christmas. But he kept going for another 2 years because he had that fight in him. He never wanted the disease to win.
Yeah. How did your job change, I suppose, once he got too sick?
You added nurse onto everything else that I did. For the last year of his life, maybe just over a year, he had a central line in his chest because we were giving him infusions 3 times a day of ganciclovir, which was something to fight losing his eyesight. But he didn't want nurses coming and going non-stop. So we were taught, two of us, Joe Finelli and myself, were taught how to do the infusions. What he had said to the doctors, I mean, he knew nothing that they would give him would make him live. But it was at the time, towards the end of his time, was when they were starting with the drug, you know, the multiple drug therapies. And he had said to the doctors that if they could find something that they wanted to try out, he said, use it on me. It will not cure me, but it might help you find something that will help other people. We were also given all these different drugs to use and how, you know, sort of like something like 5 milliliters injected over 5 minutes and that sort of stuff. We had all of these things that we had to do with him and for the doctors. I don't know. It wasn't Freddie that we were doing this to.
Yeah, I understand.
It was just someone there that it was, you know, that Freddie said, look, you have to do this.
So when you think of Freddie, you don't think of those last 4 years. You think of the years before that.
Yeah, but also during the 4 years, because he did some amazing music in those last 4 years. So again, it was an important part of him. I remember on the Thursday before he died, he said to us, look, I need to talk with Jim Beach, who was the band's manager, Freddie's manager, also a lawyer and everything. And he said, look, because it's time that I made this statement, so I've got to talk to Jim about it. Because Freddie knew he would make a statement before he died. And at this time, he had stopped taking any drugs that kept him alive for... this was about the 10th day, 10th, 11th day. All he had was painkillers. And so Jim Beach came over on the Friday, and they were talking for 4 or 5 hours, wording that statement that was released on the Friday evening. And before it was released, Jim Beach came down and he talked to us in the kitchen and told us what was going to happen. And the way it was put to us was, look, just so that you know that this is going to happen, because all of us had been lying for 4 years to friends, to family, to everybody. Because anytime anybody says, oh, but Freddie's sick, he's got AIDS. No, he's got sort of something wrong with his liver. That was the one he favoured. Freddie liked the idea that he had something wrong with his liver. Mm. So that's what we were telling people. So whatever statement was made was making public liars out of every single one of us. And so they didn't ask permission, but they let us know, Jim Beach let us know that this is what was going to happen. And I mean, when the statement was put out, nobody knew Freddie was going to be dead within 48 hours. Freddie didn't know, Jim didn't know, none of us knew. I spent the night with him after the statement was released, because for the last week of his life, there was someone with him 24 hours a day. And whether it was at night, afternoon, daytime, someone was with him. And I spent the Friday night with him, and he seemed much more relaxed that night, because it was a burden taken off his shoulders.
Then why didn't he do it earlier?
Because he didn't want everybody staring at his parents, at his sister, at us, because every single one of us would have been tarred with the AIDS brush.
Yeah, we've got to remember it was a very different time.
Yes, very much so.
The fact, though, that it was only 48 hours later that he died, that was the last thing he wanted to do, quite literally?
I think so, because the thing is, as I think in his mind, that once the world knew, then he didn't want to be around anymore. Mm. He didn't want to see the speculation. He didn't want to see what the press were going to write. He just wanted it over and done with, I think. I mean, if he had his way, 6 months earlier, we would have taken him to the doctor. The doctor could have given him an injection and put him to sleep. He was in Switzerland. He went to Switzerland at the beginning of November. And while he was there, something somehow, somewhere was said. And we had press outside the door, outside the gate at Garden Lodge, 24 hours a day. There was, during the daytime, 10, 12 people. And at night, a minimum of 3. So I rang him and I told him, because I was at home in Garden Lodge, he was in Switzerland with doing the last bits of recording and things that he was doing. And it was when he came back on the 10th of November, he came back from Switzerland on the Sunday, and that's when he had told us that he would have no more life-giving drugs. He had decided it was time. Because he knew he could not go outside his house anymore without, you know, the threat of photographers being there.
It's remarkable in a way that he was concerned about what the press would be saying about him, because when he did die, just those 2 days later, there were unbelievable eulogies.
That only lasted for about 5-6 days, and then the snide remarks started coming. It didn't take long before they would dig up all the old dirt.
That's Peter Freestone. And his book is simply titled Freddie Mercury.
And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.